Welcome back to Jazz United. This is Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours on WBGO.
And I'm Nate Chenin, editorial director at WBGO.
We'd like to get together to talk about what's on our minds and illuminate many of the great practitioners of our music. And today we wanted to celebrate and memorialize the legacy of the great Ralph Peterson Jr.
A fantastic drummer, bandleader, composer, educator. As you heard on this opening track, Further Foe, just a force of nature, one of those musicians who announces his presence from the very first note, you know, someone that takes control of every measure of music that he plays. The vitality of his playing when you hear him, you know, it really kind of, it defies comprehension that he's gone in some ways, because when you put this music on, it's just like, it is the most alive sounding thing that I can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Much like his mentor before him, Art Blakey, Ralph Peterson has the sonority of a big band drummer and the velocity of a big band drummer. But oftentimes in a small band context, you feel him as well as hear him. And man, I tell you, first coming into this music in the 1980s, three guys, Smitty Smith, Tane Watts, and Ralph Peterson, they pretty much led the way for me to understand truly what modern jazz drumming is really about.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, those three guys really sort of redefined the terms of what it means to be a jazz drummer in that decade. You know, they came up, you know, more or less at the same time. They played on a lot of the same gigs. But Greg, you located what made Ralph distinct, you know, that direct lineage to Art Blakey. Mm-hmm. I can think of very few jazz musicians who have a stronger bond with a mentor, elder, precursor, you know?
Right.
He really was proud to carry that torch, and he did so in ways that were not just musical, but also spiritual, you know, and deeply personal. He really internalized the entire, you know, we talk about the jazz messengers. Well, he internalized the jazz message.
He did.
And he imparted it to really generations of musicians in his own peer circle and, you know, and younger students.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about what we lost, it's multidimensional, you know. It's more than just a killer drummer, although he was certainly that. There's a lot of things that you know, that we will miss now that Ralph is gone.
Absolutely. Thinking about his origins on the scene as a player, I just have to mention the Newark connection. Going to school at Rutgers University and studying under Michael Carvin, nonetheless.
Yeah.
Just an amazing drummer who knows the ins and the outs of the instrument, but also the on-the-job training. You know, when we talk about Newark, New Jersey, and towns like it, stiff competition, people music, you know, folks coming to enjoy something right away. You don't have a lot of time to get it right. You have to hit and you have to mean every note that you play. You know, clubs back in the day like Sparky J's and LC's that were organ rooms, they needed a drummer that could handle that type of velocity and feel good to keep their customers, you know, coming back again and again. And Ralph Peterson, he got it honestly, man.
Yeah, he was a communicator, right? I want to return to that, but as we're talking about those formative moments in his life, we should go further back and mention that he was born into this sort of drummer family. You know, his grandfather played drums, four uncles played drums, but his father, Ralph Sr., was a police officer in Pleasantville, New Jersey, and he actually became the first black chief of police in that town. And you have to imagine the kind of character that it takes to be that sort of pioneer. You know, I got the impression that he was a pretty strict disciplinarian. And there's a lot about his upbringing that Ralph internalized. And then there are other things that I think he might have pushed against.
Okay. Okay.
But, you know, he came up in a very rigorous and respectful environment. And so it was like this combination of that discipline and the kind of social freedom that you're describing in the clubs. You know, I think that push-pull is really key to understanding Ralph Peterson. You know, the intensity that mm-hmm. that could be very strict or very free.
Yeah, he really came by it, honestly, like you mentioned, his legacy. But oftentimes, you know, people ask us, you know, you guys are inside of this music, and sometimes you guys know these practitioners. And today, I want to pull the cover back a little bit, Nate, and get you to share with us just a little bit. If you can take us back, please, to the mid-90s, moving to the continental United States for the first time. you had your sights set on a goal, and you encountered Ralph Peterson. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, I arrived in Philadelphia in 1994 and was not going to music school, but I threw myself into the informal music school of the Philadelphia Jazz Club scene.
Right.
And, you know, met the players who were on the scene, people like Byron Landham, who were very encouraging. And, you know, I wasn't getting any formal musical training at my university. And so all the musicians that I encountered, everybody said, man, you know, you should really get with Ralph.
Like, mm-hmm.
you know, it was kind of this thing. Like, if you're a serious young drummer on the scene in Philly, he's your man, you know. And he was in that in South Jersey at the time.
Okay.
And so I reached out and he became my teacher. You know, he'd come over to my apartment, often bringing his trumpet. We haven't yet mentioned that Ralph was a serious trumpet player.
Yes, he was.
And so he'd come and we would work on stuff. Sometimes it would just be the two of us playing, you know, playing through a form. But a lot of it was that, you know, that more soulful kind of instruction where, you know, he'd be playing a gig someplace and say, hey, come on out this Saturday. I want you to see something. And I'd come out and he'd be playing the gig. And the next thing I know, he points at me in the crowd, mm-hmm. you know, with a finger and beckons me up on the bandstand, you know, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden I'm playing Ralph's drums with Drew Gress and Uri Kane, and uh-huh. and Ralph is out front on his trumpet. Everybody used to joke that he just wanted an opportunity to play his horn,
but yeah,
but it was, you know, yeah. it was like that. It was a very, mm-hmm. You know, I think a version of the same kind of training that he got,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. this combination of like deep study and practice, but then also just like, I'm just going to throw an audible here, like, and you need to be able to deal.
That's right. That's right. My experience originally with Ralph Peterson was much, much different. And it was through the instruction, information, and I dare say a bit of propaganda that's come to be known as the Young Lions movement or Neo-Bop. Mm-hmm. As a very young child, being enamored with Miles Davis and wanting to learn more about him, I hung on every word I could find in magazine articles and so forth. And someone asked Miles about Neo-Bop, and as terse as he could be, Miles said that the Neo-Bop was, quote, warmed over turkey, unquote. And I didn't let that deter me, although still to this day, you know, musically, I ride with Miles from 1944 to 1991, but I wanted to know about this sound that these folks were talking about. And listening to the local radio station that I later worked for, we would hear, you know, all of these cats. One of the groups was OTB, Out of the Blue. And even at the time, I wasn't as hip as who the exact personnel were, but I could connect right away to the vibe and the feel. It felt like they were extending the language of the second great Miles Davis quintet. And, you know, those cats in that particular language were showing us about groove, rhythm, feel, but a different level of interaction. And in Ralph Peterson's case, hearing him almost dialogue in real time with whatever mm-hmm. soloists that he was backing up was a new thing to me. And I just, have to say what a bedrock development that has been in the music. All the drummers now, you have to know how to do that. And it really started with Ralph and his generation.
I want to unpack something about that, Greg, because mm-hmm. when you talk about that era and those young arrivals, you know, they were known as the Young Lions. This is the generation that comes up, you know, right in the beginning of the 80s. So, mm-hmm. you know, Wynton and Branford Marsalis, Terrence Blanchard and Donald Harrison, you know, and Ralph was right up in there. Mm-hmm. There's stuff associated with that moment that is extra musical. Some of it has to do with presentation and, you know, sartorial choices. You know, it was meaningful that here were these young, very hip, very smart, well-groomed, articulate young black men wearing Brooks Brothers suits and, you know, appearing studious, you know, like they were sure. athletic in their musicianship, but they were mm-hmm. also, you know, very mm-hmm. clearly students of a tradition. And all of that mm-hmm. was how they were packaged and presented. And, right. you know, Ralph fit right in terms of his intellect and in terms of his mastery of the language. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, when you revisit his playing, you know, behind Terrence and Donald, for instance, mm-hmm. Or on his own early Blue Note albums, you know, that have that hard boppish energy. Yeah. Yeah. There is something just uncontainable about his playing. Mm-hmm. You know, he does not really fit that mold. He sounds at every moment, you know, it's almost like the Young Lion image was Bruce Banner.
Yeah.
And you've used this metaphor before, Greg.
I hear you.
Ralph mm-hmm. Ralph was always like that panel in the comic where the Hulk is tearing yeah. the clothes and he's just beginning his transformation. He's bursting out, right?
Uh-huh.
He always sounds like that. And right. I feel like in certain ways that's why his stuff still holds up from mm-hmm. that period, because mm-hmm. it's so energetic. But it's also one reason why I think he didn't really like he was always like a little bit out of place because there was something sort of very sort of acceptable and presentable about the Young Lion ethos. Mm-hmm. And right. and Ralph, right. he was too unruly in his energies, even though he had absolute pinpoint precision mm-hmm. On his instrument. Does that all make sense?
Absolutely. And let's go further into that bag. Ralph Peterson originally is a funk cat, and he didn't mm-hmm. hide it. And I think yeah. the energy of rock and roll and of R&B and specifically funk music was something that those musicians came by very naturally, but many of them eschewed and avoided in an effort to be more authentic, let's say, to the right. style that they were representing in. And they had a lot of weight on their shoulders, if you think about it. Presentation that you also mentioned was very instructional and influential. You know, Art Blakey says they see you before they hear you. They were trying to mm-hmm. win respect for this music in a way that perhaps jazz hadn't really had for a long time.
There's no question. There's no question that it didn't have that respect, and that was a hard fought battle, and mm-hmm. and one that I'm glad they took up. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting when you think about Blakey, because he was, you know, he was held up as the exemplar for this mm-hmm. generation. You know, he was the mentor who, you know, who put his stamp on everyone from Wynton to Terrence to, you know, Jeff Keyser to, you know, just so many people who came up. The funny thing about Blakey is he didn't have that sort of veneer of respectable politesse either. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He was explosive always.
Right.
And so right. it's an interesting tension, I think, between this kind of, you know, slightly bookish presentation and then just this raging furnace that mm-hmm. that Art Blakey represented. And I feel like sure. Ralph was like, sure. that's what I want. That is yeah. that is the essence. That mm-hmm. is that is what I'm connecting with.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, a transformational moment in his career is in 1983 when Blakey basically taps him on the shoulder and says, look, I've got this big band. We got two drummers in this thing, and I want you to be my second.
Yeah.
And, you know, for Ralph, I mean, he has said that that was like being seated at the right hand of the Father, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He understood how important that was, and he soaked it all up, you know. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, this is something we can talk about openly, because Ralph certainly did. Mm-hmm. At this same moment, he was in the throes of addiction.
Wow.
You know, this is through the 80s. He had a problem with crack cocaine. And he was, so you have to imagine precisely at this moment when he's on the rise and in the spotlight, he is going through, you know, an extreme personal crisis. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's one that he struggled with during his time as a Blue Note Records artist. You know, a lot of musicians in his circle were burned by his behavior as mm-hmm. an addict. And he finally got clean in the mid-90s and was very open about you know, the battle and the ongoing struggle. And so actually, you know, I don't think I realized it at the time, but when I met him, he was really just a year or two into a life of sobriety.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is something that he was very open about with his students. There is a real awareness of fallibility mm-hmm. you know, that he often spoke about, you know, that you are always one step away from sort of plunging into the abyss if you're not careful. And it became, you know, sort of a mission for him to give credit to those who helped him and to express, you know, that humility of the survivor, you know,
yeah.
say like, I almost completely blew it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and yet here I am. And every day I have to make the decision to choose the right path.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Wow. What a soldier. In thinking back about Ralph and just that generation, there were no contests to legitimize you as the next, you know, jazz so-and-so or black music so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
These cats came up through the real deal training system. You know, the griots in the community would anoint them the next drummer, the next trumpet player, the next bass player. And to have Art Blakey's endorsement, as you spoke of earlier, was, I mean, who else would have wanted anything greater than that? I mean, it's really a testament to Ralph's place in the lineage, not to just play beside Blakey, but to get those hard lessons. And again, substance abuse has been a problem for a long time in our community. But the way that Ralph addressed it candidly, honestly, and understood that, you know, the struggles that he endured and overcame shaped not only his life, but his music. He wasn't telling you to go and follow exactly what he did, but he's acknowledging that his growth and triumph should be something that should be experienced in his sound as well. And I think he had a really honest, rugged grasp of who he was and of what he meant to this culture. And it's evident in the folks that studied with him and played with him. This cat was a soldier, man.
Yeah. You know, in his obituary, which I wrote on the day that I learned of his passing, I referred to him as a warrior philosopher. And I think that encapsulates something about him, because he really thought about, you know, those notions of attacking and, you know, and charging into battle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he also... he also always put that into a framework, into a kind of like method of thought, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was never interested in just, you know, blowing things up for the sake of the combustion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was always like so much intelligence you know, his deployment of those energies.
Yeah.
What he does with the placement of the beat, it's so precise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's often riding the front end of the beat. You know, it's very different from like the Elvin Jones model. You know,
sure.
He's a lean forward kind of drummer, but when he needs to, he will move that placement, and he will he'll tilt it, he'll shift, and I honestly don't know if there is anyone on that instrument who ever listened more acutely than Ralph.
You wow.
Know? I think some of that may go back to his, you know, his own training as a trumpet player, you know, the fact that he understood all of music. You know, he understood theory
yes,
and
he
harmony
did.
And composition.
Yes, he did.
You know, I think he's quite an underrated composer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tyshawn Sorey is a similar person. Another New Jersey native,
right?
You know, product of Newark, in fact. But Tyshawn,
right.
You know, came up playing trombone, and I think has a similar. You know, there's a kinship there in terms of that ability to hear three-dimensionally, you
mm-hmm.
know, from one moment to the next.
Exactly. And like Tyshawn, you know, who studied with Ralph, Ralph Peterson had, you know, these different looks, these different ways to express his compositional vision. You know, there's the quintets that we all appreciate. There's three or four versions of his triangular project, his piano trio situations. There's the Fotet. There's the Messenger's Legacy Big Band. Ralph had you set for all occasions, man. It didn't matter what you wanted. He could bring it to you.
Right. And as we said, the Fotet is the band we heard at the beginning of this episode. Really one of my favorite bands that Ralph led. It featured saxophone, vibraphone, bass, and drums.
Right.
The main vibraphone and marimba player that he worked with was Brian Carrot. And for a long time, the saxophonist was Steve Wilson,
mm-hmm.
With Belden Bullock on bass.
Right.
And this was just a great band, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In his composing and arranging for this band, because, you know, they played Monk's music, they played Ornette's music, Ralph did a really cool job of taking advantage of the sonic properties of that instrumentation. You know, he was really smart about how he used the vibraphone. You know, sometimes there's like a lot of harmonic texture in that band, and sometimes it's very sparse and very percussive. You know, the beauty
mm-hmm.
of mallet percussion, right? It's like
right.
You can chime and fill up that space, or you can, you know, get super clattery with it. And so the Fotet, I love that about that band, because there was so much flexibility in the atmospheric texture.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph was really smart about that, and he did that as an orchestrator with his big band as well.
Right, right. Those are great projects. I'm definitely partial to his quintet from the early 2000s with mm-hmm. Jeremy Pelt, Jimmy Green, Orrin Evans, and Eric Rivas. They made three critically acclaimed discs for the Criss Cross label, one of them being The Art of War disc, which may be my favorite Ralph Peterson composition if forced to choose just one.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another track on that record called Freight Train that truly encapsulates how to grab the spirit of what was going on in the music then, you know, all of these odd meter type tunes. But Ralph did it in a way that was grooving and swinging all at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
You could still pat your foot to it. You know, there's what, three bars of four and then one bar of six, but you're not doing math. You're just nodding your head.
Mm-hmm.
You're enjoying the solos.
Yeah.
And I think that is what he was about. He wanted to be sophisticated. He wanted to show the mastery that he had inherited and earned, but he wanted you to have a good time, and he wanted you to come back to his gig, and
yeah.
he knew how to blend that visceral thing and cerebral so well.
And when you talk about the other players on this, in that band, you know, for the most part, they are you know, I guess you could call them from the next generation. You know, they're not mm-hmm. that much younger than Ralph, but they're but right. they come from the next wave.
They sure do.
And, you know, Oren certainly had a deep relationship with Ralph. But really, you know, all of them, you know, and there are others, right? There are people like Wayne Escoffery, mm-hmm. you know, there are other musicians who formed these deep relationships with him from a different generational vantage. But, you know, Greg, you mentioned mm-hmm. it. Freight Train is one of the first tracks that I turned to as well. So, you know, I wonder, as you talk about that, let's hear a window of that tune. That's a Ralph Peterson composition, Freight Train, from his album The Art of War, featuring Jeremy Pelt on trumpet, Jimmy Green on tenor saxophone, Oren Evans on piano, and Eric Rivas on bass. I wanted to ask, Greg, do you have any personal recollections of seeing Ralph in action?
No, to be honest, but I saw him on a couple of panels during the yearly gathering. It was first called Jazz Connect. Now it's the Jazz Congress.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed with not only Ralph's level of description of drumming and the legends that he had played with, but his relatability, you know, just hanging after the sessions was over. You know, he wasn't trying to run out and, you know, dodge people. He wanted to be among the community. Ralph was concerned with that just as much as he was with the bandstand. I want to kind of talk a little bit about Ralph's entrepreneurial spirit. It's kind of interesting the period that you two got together in the 90s. He was teaching a lot. He was still playing a lot. But Ralph was kind of at the crossroads with a lot of the companies, you know, that he mm-hmm. was dealing with.
Yeah.
And to really launch out and to make his own label at that time was pretty gutsy, I would say.
You know, it's funny. When I look back now, I realize that I caught him at a transitional moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to note here that Ralph put out some incredible albums on Blue Note Records as a leader. And you cannot stream those. You cannot mm-hmm. buy them through Blue Note. The only way to get them is to go to the secondary market, you know, go hit up Discogs or go to your local record shop.
Yeah.
And there's something really unjust about that. You know, when you think about, I think people often have this assumption that everything is available now. You know, some people think everything is on Spotify. We know that's not true, but,
that's right.
But you know, I mean, literally these albums, you know, the first Triangular record with Jerry Allen, This great album, Five or V, you know, which had Terrence Blanchard, Steve Wilson, Jerry, and Phil Bowler on bass. Mm-hmm. You know, I bought my vinyl copy at the Princeton Record Exchange for $3. And yeah. I'm so glad I have it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Volition, another one. Mm-hmm. So these albums are, they should be a part of the common understanding of that era.
Right.
And, you know, I will take this moment with whatever bully pulpit I have to urge Blue Note Records to do the right thing here. You know, these albums should be back in circulation. You know, the frustration of his experience with Blue Note and its catalog department, that's part of what led him to form this label, Onyx Music, which, you know, ultimately became a really prolific platform for him. You know, he released, I think, more than 20 albums
Yeah.
And there's actually one coming this spring featuring a rhythm section that he really connected with, Lucas Curtis on bass and Zakai Curtis, his brother, on piano. And I'll tell you, I was really excited when I learned this. Jasmia Horn is also on this album. And the reason I'm excited is because in the summer of 2019, I think it was, I went to see Jasmia at the Jazz Standard. And lo and behold, Ralph was on drums. And it was this funny moment, like, what are you doing here, man? Like, what is Ralph Peterson doing playing drums on a Jasmia Horn gig, you know? I wish I could relive that night, because the energy that he brought to her bandstand and the kick that he gave her, and then the authority with which she took that energy and gave it back to the audience. You know what I mean? It was like the chi was moving around the room. He and I actually talked about it after the set. He was like, yeah, I gave it, you know, and she could take it, and yeah, she transformed it, you know, stepping up to the plate. You know, that's one of those things. I think any musician who played with Ralph, and played with Ralph a second time will say that, like, there was an intense exchange of energy, right?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
But we should say there's lots of other, projects on his label. Do you have any favorites? Is there anything that he's put out in the last, you know, 10 years that really speaks to you?
His organ projects are really special. There's a live one, I believe, from Firehouse 12 in his Alive series. He has like 6 volumes of his Alive series. But one of them features Pat Bianchi at the organ for... basically, some Larry Young hewn selections, plus a couple of originals. And it's really awesome to hear someone really investigate the language. Again, earlier we're talking about Ralph in Newark, New Jersey, and playing those early organ rooms. One of the leading practitioners of that instrument hails from Newark, and that is Larry Young. You know, the language of that band, it's so of its time, but it really looks forward with some of the energy and the gusto that you can hear on the scene today.
You know, I want to take this moment to mention that Ralph had a wonderful, I'm not sure if it was last 15 years or so, but when he joined the faculty at Berkeley, he had an institution that enabled him to put his pedagogy into a frame, you know. He really savored that. And I mentioned Lucas Curtis, that's one of his students. Godwin Louis was another. Godwin told me that really Ralph was the one person throughout his entire jazz education experience who really taught him what it meant to be an artist in this music, you know.
Amazing,
the uncompromising integrity that you need, the perseverance that you need, the fire that you have to tend. You know, all of that stuff is, you know, that's the kind of stuff that Ralph was able to instill in his students at Berkeley. And he also formed a big band called the Gen Next Big Band. One great example, you mentioned, Greg, The Art of War. On their most recent album titled Listen Up, the Gen Next Big Band plays that tune in a, you know, a big band arrangement. And you can hear just the youthful energy, but also the clarity that he brought to that platform. It's heartening, right? Because it's a reminder that the talent is still coming. Like they're still coming up.
I want to mention a few drummers, too, that passed through on his watch at Berkeley in the persons of Mark Whitfield Jr., as well as Ari Honig. In Ari's case, his whole conception of melodically recasting melodies, some of that language was pre-developed from Ralph Peterson. I watched an interview very recently, just maybe a day or so ago, of Ralph speaking about the importance of hearing the actual tones in the melody, but more specifically, the cadence and the rhythms in melodies, and using that to develop language and soloing, in how to build a solo, and just taking that whole deal of being able to, you know, on the drums, you know, state the melodies. And this cat, Ari Honig, you know, we've all heard him. Amazing. Able to get, you know, four pitches out of, you know, these different pieces of his drum kit. But Ralph Peterson is a forerunner in that style and in that sound. And it's just awesome to be able to have a drummer like that influence this culture, you know, as he has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amen to that. I think it might be time for us to cue up a little something that we uncovered as we were putting this episode together. You know, Greg, you mentioned the Messenger Legacy Band. You know, we've already sung its praises. And we've talked about Berkeley and what Berkeley meant to Ralph. Years ago now, Berkeley posted a video of the Messenger Legacy Band from a concert called Celebrating Blakey in 2013. Live at the Berkeley Performance Center. So this is a band that includes Donald Harrison, who we've talked about, and trumpeter Brian Lynch, tenor saxophonist Billy Pierce, Donald Brown on piano, and Reggie Workman on bass. So these are all people who passed through the Blakey Academy at one point or another. And it's if you've listened to this podcast before, you may recognize this tune.
More and more I think about just the generation that we're now a part of, we're seeing a lot of the torches and the mantles and the batons being passed. And it's really sad and sentimental to see folks that, you know, we never thought would leave here passing away and not being physically a part of the scene. But again, as music is vibration, and as information and wisdom is transferred, these cats don't really leave us at all. We have their records. We have their example in the persons of people on the scene now. And it's just a testimony to the level of sacrifice, ingenuity, talent, and spirit that is Ralph Peterson Jr. So folks, we just wanted to put the spotlight on Ralph, and we hope that you dug the coverage. If you dig his music, share his music, buy his music still on his Onyx Bandcamp site. But we want you to continue to share and spread this music. That's how it stays. Even when all of us are away from here, the music will still be here. And Ralph Peterson is an example of that legacy, and I'm just glad we got to talk about him today.
Yeah, me too. This was, I needed this. And you're so right about the aliveness of the music. I mean, just find a record that Ralph plays on. Just put it on. Yeah. It will improve your day.
It will make you feel
a kind of, I don't know, it'll stir some feelings about just how vital this music can be. You know, he always brought that conviction to any session, to any bandstand, and you know, he is already deeply missed, but his music, as you say, lives on and will continue to live on.
That's right. Let's go out with one that recaps the power, the force that Ralph brought to everything he did. This is a tune from Onward and Upward, and it's called Forth and Back. Folks, we want to remind you, we are a listener-supported station here at WBGO. This podcast originates from WBGO, and we would love to have your support. Whatever you can do, you can even become a sustaining member for as little as $8 a month. And you can give securely online, wbgo.org/support. And you can tell them that the good folks at Jazz United sent you over there. Just one of the many programs that we provide here on WBGO. We've got something really hip coming up next show as well.
That's right. WBGO has been celebrating Women's History Month during the month of March. And for our next episode, we will welcome our friend and colleague, Kiana Faircloth, the host of Afternoon Jazz and the host of The Pulse. And Kiana's going to talk about a very special edition of The Pulse that she conducted earlier this month. So hang tight. Join us again on Jazz United next time. We've got some good stuff coming.
Jazz United is a podcast from WBGO with yours truly, Greg Bryant, and our editorial director, Nate Chenin. Our producer is Sarah Kirsten. Our senior producer is Simon Rentner. You can get Jazz United wherever you subscribe to podcasts, as well as at wbgo.org. We'll see you again real soon.